You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, that's the sound of Paris-Nice. My name is Richard Moore, and I'm in Gien by the banks of the Loire at Paris-Nice. Philippe Gilbert just finishing the time trial, stage three of the race. I will be joined a little bit later on by Francois Thomazeau, who's here as well, and we'll be talking about what's been going on here. Oh, tight corner after the time trial. Before that, I'm going to be joining up remotely with Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney to talk mainly about Strade Bianche, but also a bit about Paris-Nice as well. But lots of talking points from Tuscany and the phenomenal performance by Mathieu van der Poel in a great race. So we'll be talking about that in the first part of this week's podcast. Before we join up with Lionel and Daniel and then return to me and Francois a bit later on, let's hear a little bit of music. This was sent in by a listener.
Daniel Free, Silicon. Daniel Free, Silicon. Take your SIS gels and put your helmet on. Daniel Free, Silicon.
Well, that was podcast listener Steve Nichols from New Zealand, who says he couldn't help but come up with a song, the song that we've just heard, during his morning commute. We'll play out with the full version then, but Daniel, what did you think?
Well, this small lapsus has been a bigger story than Meghan and Harry, is all I can say. And like Piers Morgan, I might have to flounce off at some point.
Don't be diabolical, Daniel. An extraordinary submission from Steve. It obviously picks up the story of Pavel Sivakov and his aborted mission to the moon. Or his never was mission to the moon. I thought Siv might do well on the lunar-like roads of Tuscany, but it was the Van der Poel show, wasn't it? A trillion watts Mathieu van der Poel put out to win Strade Bianche. Lots of debate about whether it should be a monument. Who knows and who cares? But it was an absolutely cracking race. And as I said in the opening part of the podcast, we'll talk about that mainly in part one. I'm with Daniel Freeb, who you heard there, and Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard. Hello.
How's your arm, napalm?
Arm is fine. Collarbone is still pretty sore. I thought by now it would be just fine. The riders, they're racing again by now, day nine after the accident, aren't they? They're sometimes racing the next day in a Grand Tour. Riders have ridden on with fractured collarbones, haven't they? Can't quite get my head around that because it's really quite painful. I mean, obviously, your sympathies expressed so eloquently in last week's podcast gave me a massive boost, Daniel. Particularly you saying that you don't need your collarbone to podcast, which is admittedly a fair point,
fair comment.
Yeah, but I mean, are you able to laugh now, Lionel? I'm just asking this, I don't want to inject any humour into the podcast in case if it's going to cause you some pain or discomfort.
Don't worry about that, Rich. don't worry. You're fine on that score.
Well, Rich, you noted before we started recording that Lionel is very pointedly hiding away. We can't see him as we're recording this. And that throws up all sorts of scenarios and conspiracy theories, echoes, shades of the Chris Froome crash conspiracy theories.
Simon Gill is wild poles in this case because Simon Gill was with him. He was the witness to this crash. I've not seen any pictures of Lionel since it happened. Lionel?
Well, it's obvious that I've fractured my collarbone, Richard, yeah. And the reason you can't see me is because I've only got one hand that I can actually use at the moment because my other arm is in a sling and I can't balance my phone up at an angle. So you've got a view of the ceiling of my office. Sorry about that.
Well, the mystery continues. but what you do have our, assuming it's true and you have broken your collarbone, you have our absolute
deepest
sympathy.
Really, don't go overboard.
I think about you every day, Lionel.
Anyway, where are you, Richard? You're okay. Your background, you've got it's a generic piece of artwork on the wall behind you there. It looks very much like a hotel room. under curfew? I guess you are.
I am under curfew. I've struck lucky because I'm in a delightful bed and breakfast where I'm the only resident. They only take one guest at a time, so I can eat in the dining room, which I have done this evening. And it's a really beautiful place, close to where today's stage was, so just north of the Loire. And running down the back of the house is a canal, alongside which is a path, and it's part of a long-distance cycle path from Norway to Spain, the La Scandiberic, which opened in 2018, I believe. I don't know much about this, but it sounds like an incredible adventure to be undertaken, maybe for the an episode of Explore. Have you heard of the Scandiberic?
No, I must confess I haven't, Rich.
La Scandiberic. Anyway, enough of that. Can we get on with the news roundup, please, Lionel?
Indeed, Rich. Yeah, well, a very racing-focused news roundup this week, and quite a week for Matthew van der Poel. At Le Samin, he broke his handlebars, and at Strada Bianca, he broke the sound barrier, almost, with his 1,000-watt attack, apparently, leaving the world champion Julian Alaphilippe and a former Tour de France winner Egan Bernal looking almost like they were standing still on the run-in to Siena. A really impressive victory for van der Poel there. And it was a great week all round for his Alpecin Fenix team, because his teammate Tim Merlier, the former Belgian champion, won both Le Samin and the Grand Prix Jean-Pierre Montserrat. The runner-up in the latter of those two races was Mark Cavendish for De Koenig Quickstep. Meanwhile, over in Italy, there were two one-day races at the Trofeo Laguiglia. That was won by Trek Segafredo's Bauke Mollema. He went clear in the final stages and finished solo ahead of Bernal and Mauri van Sevenant. And Mauri van Sevenant, the young De Koenig Quickstep rider, then won the Gran Premio Industria e Artigianato ahead of Mollema, Mikel Landa and Nairo Quintana. And that's the race that goes over the San Baronto climb in Tuscany that the Giro did a few years ago, I think a couple of years ago. Does laps over that climb. And, well, van Sevenant, a big win for him, a breakthrough win. Remember, he was the rider off the front at Flèche Wallonne last autumn. He was away solo, looking pretty good. He was certainly going to get to the bottom of the Mur de Huy on his own, but he had that crash going downhill and lost his chance that day. But clearly a rider to watch. Meanwhile, the women's Strada Bianca was won by Chantal Vandenbroek Black, who dropped the Italian champion Elisa Longo-Borghini on the climb into Siena. And Richard, I'm expecting you, Orla and Rose, to have the full lowdown on the women's race in the next episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminam, which is coming out when?
Coming out this week, Lionel. Yeah, the story of the season so far in women's cycling has been SD Works. They've really come out of the traps very well indeed, the old Bulls Dolmans team. So yeah, Cycling Podcast Femina will be out later this week.
And of course, the Race to the Sun, Richard, which you're following all the way down to Nice, Paris to Nice. So far, we've had three stages as we're recording. Sam Bennett of De Koenig Quickstep won the opener. Case Ball of DSM won stage two. And the current holder of the yellow jersey is EF Education Nippo Stefan Bissiger, who won the time trial today. Quite a short time trial, only 14.5 kilometres or thereabouts. Remember, he was second to Filippo Ganna, who won by quite a distance the time trial in the UAE Tour a couple of weeks ago, but netted his first big World Tour win in pretty impressive style. And we'll talk about Paris-Nice a little bit before we hear your dispatch from the race, Rich.
Can I add something, chaps, to the roundup? Breaking news?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Well, a news story broken by Ciro, our old mate Ciro, today involving another of our old mates, Pippo Pozzato, the peacock of Sandrigo, il pavone di Sandrigo. He's been working, scheming for a few months now on a race that he hopes to launch. It's actually a kind of resuscitation of an old race, the Giro del Veneto, the Veneto being the region of Italy that encapsulates, includes Venice, and is also Pozzato's native region. Anyway, Pozzato wants the Giro del Veneto to be revived. He is going to be the head honcho, the race director, I presume, after the Tour of Lombardy, after Il Lombardia, so in the autumn. And it's going to involve some gravel roads, some sterrato, which has led Ciro and I to speculate over what we'll colloquially refer to the race as. Of course, the Peacock of San Diego, we used to call Pozzardo Il Pavone. So we're going to call this race La Pavonata Bianca, the White Peacock Straganza, would be the closest translation.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWaka. If you run a business, find out more at iwaka.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thanks very much to our headline sponsor, iWaka. We're grateful to them for their support. And over the last couple of weeks, we've heard from Colin Goldstein at iWaka about their partnership with Mental Health UK. Let's hear a little bit more from Colin now.
There's no doubt in our mind that borrowing money and the financial health of a small business is linked to the mental health of a small business owner. We did some research recently into the whole area of mental health for small business owners, and more than three quarters of the small business owners that we surveyed said that they've been worried about cash flow during the pandemic. We do see that longer term, we need to have baked into our whole approach to dealing with our customers an appreciation for mental health concerns as they go through the process of borrowing money to help develop and grow their business. We absolutely want to look after and support the mental health of business owners that come to us for finance, but we want to make tools and supports more widely available for the small business community, not just for customers of iWaka.
Thanks again to iWaka for supporting the Cycling Podcast. And if you want to know more about what they can do for you, go to iwaka.co.uk. Well, chaps, in this part, we were going to be looking back on a pretty amazing edition of Strada Bianca with an incredible winner and an amazing front group in that race of some of the real stars of the sport, Tour de France winners, Classics winners, and Michael Gogol, to steal a line from Rob Hatch. What did you make of it, Daniel?
Well, Rich, it's funny, that theme you just mentioned of Gogol being the interloper. Among the many sort of poetic pieces that were written, I suppose, all over Europe over the weekend, and one that really caught my eye was by a friend of ours called Leo Piccione, who's part of the Bidon cycling writing collective in Italy. And he sort of elaborated on this theme of it being, well, since we always have cosmic, celestial themes in the podcast now, about it seeming slightly otherworldly, the whole race on Saturday, and Gogol being so the only human being among those extraterrestrials. This is what, and just a couple of paragraphs of Leo's piece. Where may the intrinsic merits of the race end, and where may those of the brood of polyhedral thoroughbreds who have taken hold of professional cycling begin? The fact is that watching Strade Bianche was the cycling equivalent of pointing a telescope in the direction of galaxies so far away that just looking at them is a journey into an ancient past that holds mysteries and answers to the origins of everything. In the desolation of another edition stripped of the audience it deserved, Michael Gogol was our emissary, the only human being entitled to witness from a forearm's length away the decisive stages of a race that has already gone down in history. And in the results, which future generations will pore over with the same wonder with which we now examine those of a Paris-Roubaix a century ago, there is and will still be him, the Austrian interloper, in sixth place. So that might sound a little bit disrespectful, but I mean, I think it was Leo really doffing his cap at Michael Gogol's performance, as we all did. But the whole race, as you said, Rich, you know, partly because of the event itself, Strade Bianche, it has this sort of otherworldly quality, and also arriving in Siena, a deserted Siena, there was something somber but very beautiful about it. I should point out the light, in my opinion, wasn't quite as beautiful and beguiling as it was, and we talked about that, didn't we? Or I talked about it last August for the rearranged Strade Bianche. But you know, there was a real sense of it being a huge event, a huge moment in this emergence of a new generation led by an otherworldly talent in Mathieu van der Poel, who I must admit I don't particularly connect with, precisely because he does seem to come from almost a different orbit, and almost literally in the sense that he comes from a scene that we don't know particularly well, cyclocross. He comes from, or he rides for a team which has not been around for a very long time. The personnel, to me, is quite unfamiliar. And he rides in a very unfamiliar, well, I suppose you would say now, extraterrestrial kind of way. There's a violence in the way that he rides, which almost makes him seem out of context. I was thinking, and we've had this conversation before, but I was thinking of other sports stars in other disciplines who have, you know, not just excelled when they've arrived on the scene of a particular sport, but they've seemed to, they almost, well, in Van der Poel's case, he almost cycles in a vernacular that I don't understand. I look at him and I don't really comprehend what he's able to do. But I was thinking of maybe Jonah Lomu in rugby, who seemed like a different species almost. He was so superior when he emerged in rugby. And even now in golf, we've got Bryson DeChambeau, who's doing something completely different to everyone else in the world. And yeah, for those reasons, in the past, Mathieu van der Poel has left me slightly, I wouldn't say cold, but almost confounded.
Bemused.
Yeah.
I think the piece you read there, Daniel, is really interesting on this idea of this new, not just new generation, but a new type of rider. Thomas de Gendt alluded to this on Twitter as well, saying that if he was as a cycling fan, he looks forward to watching, you know, the races over the next few years. But as a cyclist himself, he kind of dreads it because the game seems to have changed. I mean, I'm not that interested in Mathieu van der Poel's power figures at all because it doesn't matter. You know, it's a race and he won the race. But, you know, the level of performance is going up and the things he's capable of doing are kind of new. And it, you know, we spoke last week about Koerner Brussels Koerner and his performance there. And I suggested it didn't really matter that, you know, his bigger targets were further down the road. And I think Strade Bianche definitely merits his undivided kind of focus. And you know, he put in two searing attacks, one which dragged away Julian Alaphilippe and Egan Bernal, kind of clawed his way up to them. And then the final one on the climb up into Siena. And you do feel with van der Poel that when he's on that kind of form, he can really do whatever he likes and probably win every classic. That's been suggested that, you know, every single monument is certainly within his radar. But, you know, there were other notable performances. I mean, Alaphilippe maybe not at his very best yet, though I'm not sure if he was at his best, he'd have been able to match van der Poel on the final climb. But Bernal's performance, certainly very notable. An outstanding performance by him in a one-day race against, you know, real specialists. Tom Pidcock, also very good. Wout van Aert surprised me a little bit because he was the defending champion and he rode as the favourite, I thought. His team did quite a lot of work to set him up and then he seemed to take a lot of responsibility quite early in the race and I wonder if he paid for that a little bit later on. It was also his first race of the year and I think he's come in to that off the back of a lot of very hard training. So,
yeah, I think he had possibly a bit of an altitude hangover there, which possibly is a phenomenon that's quite well known.
I think we'll see a better Van Aert in the next few weeks, certainly by the time of Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, I think.
Yeah, on the race, the wider picture of the race and what it told us. I mean, we talked a few weeks ago about this phenomenon of not really knowing how coronavirus might affect things as the season goes on. People wanting to race with the form and fitness that they've got and make the most of the events that are on. I mean, the picture doesn't look too bleak at the moment, but you know, that's not to say that there won't be some disruption. And perhaps it's also a bit of a hangover from last season, that sort of sense of uncertainty and a desire to sort of get get on with things and get racing. It's bringing this collection of riders to the fore. And as you said, Rich, you know, it's three of the riders who lit up the cyclocross season, including the world champion in cyclocross, the world road champion, two former Tour de France winners, and Michael Gogel. I mean, it was a real collection of talent and different types of talent, as Daniel alluded to. And I think that's the holy grail for one day races, isn't it? And it made me think of the World Championships. Every year we kind of hope for this convergence of different types of talent, the Tour de France champions and the riders who excel in the Grand Tours going up against the classic specialists. And, you know, some years we get a taste of it, but we never get the sense that everybody in the world is, you know, in the best form at the same time. Milan-San Remo is another race where we get a little glimpse sometimes of a Grand Tour type rider going head to head with the classic specialist. But here was a bona fide clash between, you've almost got the whole spectrum of talent there, haven't you? You've got the outright Grand Tour champion, Egan Bernal. You've got the man who can do almost everything, but who so far we've seen looking extremely good in the toughest of the one-day races, Mathieu van der Poel. And then we've got Julian Alaphilippe, who does, you know, probably the one-day races slightly better than the Grand Tours, but crosses over from one to the other. And it did seem to me, from quite a long way out, just looking at the way van der Poel launched that first big attack, the conundrum for all of them was, how do we beat Mathieu van der Poel? And when it came down to the finish, the answer was, well, we probably can't. I mean, he didn't even need to do anything tactical, really. He just rode on the front and launched his attack from the front. It was a supreme display of superiority over, let's not forget, you know, two of the best riders in the world.
Chaps, I talked about van der Poel sort of cycling in a vernacular I didn't understand, but we've sort of said similar things in the past about the race itself at Strade Bianche, almost being written in a code, a kind of hieroglyphics that we're not conversing in. We haven't really got a firm hold yet on what it is, in the sense of what kind of rider, what components of a rider's skill set it really sort of calls to the fore. Are we any closer? I mean, I found myself thinking about the fact that three of that group, as you said, Lionel, were our cyclocross riders, and maybe that brought the bike handling element into sharper focus, because sometimes it can be quite difficult to quantify and really understand how much of a factor it is in that race, bike handling.
I mean, it certainly matured into a race that the very biggest riders are targeting now, hasn't it? I mean, and seeing Bernal there was really interesting. I mean, he's had a good start to the season, hasn't he? Right up there, I think second on the stage of the Tour de la Provence that went to Chalet Reynard on Mont Ventoux, and then third at L'Aiguilla just before Strade Bianche. And then in that group, looking good. And let's not forget, you know, he was with Tom Pidcock, so Ineos Grenadiers had two riders in there. And I suppose you were saying, Rich, you were surprised that Van Aert went off the back, but he went off the back with Pidcock, didn't he? And they did very well to fight back up and get up to the front group. And I think that chimes with what you're saying, Daniel, is that I didn't know when Van Aert went backwards, is that it? Is that him done? Will he come back? And I think there is still that sense that the run-in, you know, you can do a lot of work on that run-in and then pay for it on the final climb. But, I mean, van der Poel had it dialed in from a long way out, it seemed to me. I mean, easy to say in hindsight, but genuinely at the time, I was thinking, how do they beat him from here? I mean, it was, in the end, an impossible riddle.
It's a tough riders race. I mean, we've seen Romain Bardet up there. I was very struck by Pau Bilbao, was one of the strongest riders in that chasing group. You know, not a guy you would associate with a race like that, or even a one-day race at all, perhaps. But you look at the sort of the top 20, and it's a real collection of different talents and skill sets. And you know, Bardet was 20th again, actually, not really in the mix, but there or thereabouts. And Jakob Fuglsang, Simon Carr, very impressive performance for him. Tim Wellens, you know, it's just a strongman's race, isn't it? And it, you know, I think van der Poel going into it played down his chances, saying that it suited climbers. And there is some climbing in it, but they're the sort of climbs that you can get over if you're as strong as he is. I'm interested in, you know, what you say, Daniel, about not connecting with Van der Poel, because I look at him and I think that certainly if you're a young kid getting into cycling or a teenager, he's exactly the sort of personality and talent that you would be excited by. You know, the way that he's so dynamic, the way that he looks, the way that he rides.
I mean, part of it is just me being contrary, because he's particularly, there was a period when he particularly, if you weren't closely following cyclocross, when he seemed to be above all a social media phenomenon, because the volume and the passion of cyclocross fans on social media platforms is quite notable, I think, quite significant. And two or three years ago, when Van der Poel was only really having a nibble at the road, he wasn't appearing in the biggest races, and cyclocross fans were singing his praises, it didn't seem particularly relevant, and it almost seems as though, well, he's brought that fan base with him, obviously, and I don't know, maybe some of my sort of reticence is a bit of it's left over from that.
I mean, he does create a story every time he races, it seems, doesn't he? I mean, he won his first race of the year at the UAE Tour. No fault of his own that he was then out of that race because of a coronavirus case within the team. But then you guys talked about Koerner, Brussels Koerner. I mean, again, a sense that he races sometimes, and we've seen this in the classics before, almost so good and has so much strength in the tank that he can do things that other riders, you know, wouldn't contemplate. You know, he gets himself out of position almost on purpose in order to get himself back into position. And at Koerner, Brussels Koerner, it did look like, he was sort of playing a computer game on the easy setting until the very end, of course.
Would you chaps agree with what I say about in his pedal stroke, the way he rides, there's an inherent kind of violence, like a kind of brutality that I certainly see anyway, that I can't remember seeing in anyone else. And I think, you know, obviously I've watched a lot of footage of Merckx. I think that he might have been the closest.
Yeah,
a threshing machine.
Yeah, and I think that's from the cyclocross legacy, isn't it? I mean, he rides with such power through, you know, the mud and the sand, controversially, and then take the mud and the sand away, and, you know, with less resistance. You know, that's the result that we see, that the acceleration away from Alaphilippe was extraordinary. I mean, it doesn't matter what the figures are. I mean, I know I've seen, 1,000 watts quoted for, what was it, the last or 20 seconds of that attack or whatever. But I mean, it's almost an abstract concept to me, that. It doesn't really matter. The fact is that he left Julian Alaphilippe, who is a great rider, who would ordinarily suit that finish into Siena, left him with no answer whatsoever. I mean, yeah, quite remarkable. And I suppose the other thing, Daniel, I don't know whether this is how you feel about it, but the sense that we don't really know what direction Van der Poel wants to go in. We don't know how he fits into the Grand Tour landscape yet. You know, is he going to turn up at the Tour de France and, despite all the talk about prioritising the mountain bike race at the Olympic Games, is he going to actually turn up and be the star of the race this year? It's very difficult to get a handle on what he is, other than seeing on these occasions just how much he stands above the others.
I mean, he can win stage one. I would think he could win stage one of the Tour de France, couldn't he, this year?
Definitely. And chaps, most riders, as I said, I talked about the fact he's from an unfamiliar team to us anyway, to a large extent. You know, most riders, when you think of them, as part of kind of a galaxy of, or a network of, you know, teammates, even races, places. And to me, Van der Poel just seems to come from this very mysterious world that is cyclocross. But he also really has always seemed to me a lone wolf. And I always think back, and I think I've mentioned this recently, what his father, Adrie van der Poel, has always said about the way Mathieu used to approach junior races, that he didn't really believe, or Adrie didn't believe in making him follow tactics. He didn't believe that he should, even as late as the junior ranks or the under 23 ranks. He always thought that Matthew should just ride basically for himself and for the win. So that makes him a very different kind of being in the world of professional cycling, whose dogmas are all about kind of, you know, the collective and how important the team is and how important your entourage is.
Well, we'll certainly see over the next few weeks, because he's said he thinks he can hold this form for a month, which would take us up through the next stretch of classics and include Paris-Roubaix. So we will see what he's able to do. But just before we move on, I do think that Quebec at Assos deserve a bit of a mention, not just for getting Google in that front group at Strade Bianche, but they had Simon Clark in the next group, and just a little bit behind that, Robert Power as well. And I know I've focused a little bit on the team over the past few weeks, just because they had such a precarious end to last year. But that's a real, I thought, a really impressive outing for them, to see their jerseys up there in numbers. And, you know, Michael Gogol didn't look out of place until right towards the end.
Well, Lionel, I've thought that about their performances in a lot of races so far this season, and it's reminded me that, you know, we often, very often, we evaluate team seasons on the basis of how many wins they've had and how many podium places they've had, and that team over the past 3 or 4 weeks has perfectly exemplified that there are many ways to influence a race and influence the public watching the race besides actually winning it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, who's obviously working on Paris-Nice this week, reminding me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel, which is a language app to help you learn a foreign language. And Richard, you've been using Babbel to improve your French, and I guess this is the first time you've been let out in a few weeks. You've been practicing your French on your family, I guess, but out in the wild, the buffalo out in the wild, talking to real French people, using your French, has it stood you in good stead? Do you feel like you've made a bit of progress?
This is the test, Lionel. Yes, it's true, because at home I fall back on, rely on those around me who speak French properly. And that's not always a great thing when you're learning a language. Today, Lionel, I found myself in a situation where there was nothing for it but to use my French, which I have been improving thanks to Babbel, and their very fun daily, not games, but exercises and lessons, and very enjoyable they are too. But I was at the Team DSM bus talking to their press officer, Peter Reif, when a lady appeared with an artwork that she'd made, a sort of engraving on wood of Case Ball winning yesterday's stage. And she wanted to present it to Case Ball. And in these times of COVID, fans are not allowed to give gifts to riders. And it was quite a complicated exchange, which, you know, Peter couldn't speak French. So I was actually translating this exchange. I felt very, very satisfied at successfully doing that. And Peter was able to disinfect the artwork, and Case Ball appeared, and he didn't speak any French either, apparently. And so I was able to be a go-between here in this exchange between the artist and Case Ball. So, quite a satisfying moment, I have to say. I'll take these small victories.
Fantastic. Well, Babbel, as you say, there is a sort of gaming element to it, but it's about being able to use the app little and often that I found most appealing. You can do a little bit here and there if you've got 5, 10, 15 minutes to spare, and just keep building blocks of language, just putting one on top of the other and adding to your knowledge and going back and refreshing. And the lessons are created by real people, language experts, so you're not getting computer generated phrases to use. You're actually learning things that will come in handy, and you can learn one of 14 different languages, including French, Italian, Spanish and German. And you can get 6 months free if you purchase a 6-month subscription by going to babbel.co.uk/play and using the promo code cycle. So basically, sign up for 6 months and you get another 6 months free at babbel.co.uk/play with the promo code cycle.
I have to say though, Lionel, a remarkable coincidence that last night's lesson included the phrase, c'est un cadeau poor Cis Ball, because the French pronounce his name Cis rather than Case. So an amazing coincidence that, and I was able to obviously understand exactly what that meant today. Well, as we've said a few times, that front group at Strada Bianca was a real kind of who's who plus Michael Gogol. But there was another one there, Quinn Simmons, the Trek Segafredo rider, the American rider, who's been in the news quite a lot because he was suspended at the end of last year by his team for some tweets that they deemed to be offensive and that many people deemed to be offensive. But he's still only 19, he's back racing, and he was in that front group. He punctured and then looked incredibly strong trying to get back to it. He eventually crashed and finished 54th in the end.
He also, chaps, made a bit of a mockery of how strong that front group was by riding on the rim for about a kilometre on the on the punctured tire. But anyway,
I mean, whatever you think of Quinn Simmons, and lots of people have formed strong opinions about him already, he's clearly a very, very strong and talented rider who's going to be a factor in races like that. Extraordinary to think he's still only 19, former world junior champion, of course. But yeah, he could have been there. I mean, Tom Pidcock, I mentioned already, still only 21, and he was up there and seemed quite surprised to find himself in that company. Those riders are only going to get stronger and going to be contenders in those races. But I mean, how do you feel Strada Bianca? I'm not going to get into the monument conversation because we've had that already in the past. It's a bit boring and a bit irrelevant. The race itself, though, you know, where does it sit? It seems to be sort of gaining in prestige every year. I think part of that is that it's coincided with the interest in gravel riding. You know, it's kind of tapped into that as well, and it's in this sweet spot of being an exceptionally hard race in an exceptionally beautiful place, coupled with this vogue for gravel riding that has captured a lot of people's attention and imagination.
Well, it certainly is gaining prestige every year, chaps. Just something Lionel said earlier about, you know, when Wout van Aert was dropped and, you know, Lionel not really knowing at that point whether he could or couldn't get back. That just brought home to me again just how young this race is, because, you know, we rely so much on that sort of hinterland of 100 years of knowledge about, you know, whether it be the Quaremont in Flanders or the Carrefour de l'Arbre in Paris-Roubaix, and even, you know, other places, other phases in other classics. And, you know, we still are only starting to learn the secrets of this race. And it's amazing how far it has come in that time. But as you say, Rich, it's, you know, the ingredients are undeniable. And they would be the envy of, well, some of those races I've just mentioned, even, you know, Flanders and Roubaix. There are elements of Strade Bianche that even they would pale by comparison with.
I do think, just lastly, it benefits from not being 100 years old and 260 kilometres long. Because if it had been created at the start of the 20th century or before, then it and it was one of the monuments, then it would fit that same profile, wouldn't it? And I think on that sort of terrain with the gravel, you possibly would end up with a race that is much more defensive for longer. The fact that it's only 185 kilometres-ish changes the style of racing, and it makes it more of a kind of a... There's more bang for your buck, isn't there? You know, at whatever point you turn on in the last 50 kilometres, you're going to see some exciting racing, and it's not necessarily going to be done until that final climb into Siena. And last year it was held in extraordinary heat, and I thought, well, maybe this has got a future as a summer race. It started out life in the autumn, and now it's sort of settling into the spring. I mean, it really is a race for all seasons. They could do anything they want with it, and you know, almost build the Italian race calendar around it. It's become, I think, that entertaining to watch.
I can hear you both desperately trying to avoid using the word iconic. Well done for that, and good points well made, Lionel.
Epic. Did we avoid epic?
Yeah, we did avoid epic until now. Lionel, you obviously can podcast with your alleged broken collarbone. And I have to say that not only can you podcast, but you can produce a wonderful friend special, because your Paris-Nice friend special, and this is us segueing onto Paris-Nice, was released this week, and it's a great listen. It's really it's the story of Paris-Nice through Sean Kelly, or the story of Sean Kelly through Paris-Nice. I'm not quite sure which, but it's a great listen. It's had fantastic feedback already. And if you want to have a listen to the full episode, go to thecyclingpodcast.com, sign up as a friend of the podcast. Our most recent friend special before that was a special on Team DSM, formerly Sunweb, and they finally got their first win of the season here at Paris-Nice on Stage 2 with Case Ball, something they've tried countless times, including the Tour de France last year. A great lead out, and he hasn't quite managed to deliver, but he did the other day. And I don't know if you both been there. Well, I know you've certainly been paying a lot of attention to Paris-Nice, Daniel, because you're working for ITV on the race. And Lionel, well, I know it's one of your favourite races, so indeed. I guess you've been watching it as well.
Shaping up nicely, isn't it? The time trial today is, well, I mean, look, we can debate this, but it does very much look like it's falling Primoz Roglic's way after the time trial today. But, you know,
shaping up to be another Rogger side, isn't it, I think?
Indeed.
You reckon? Rog impressed you, Daniel?
Well, yeah, he has impressed me. He's never really out of form, is he? And he comes back at Paris-Nice, and he's probably the only rider in the world who, without any preparation, you would make your favourite to win a race like Paris-Nice. You know, the way, again, he's put those demons or the ghosts to rest of the final time trial in the Tour de France last year is quite impressive. His time trialing ability is very much intact against some huge engines today in the time trial along the Loire. So looking at the course for the next couple of days, I don't really see how anyone can beat him. Summit finish on Wednesday, which should be right up his alley, and I expect him to take the win and some bonus seconds in typical Rog style there. And he's generally a good defender, and that team have been pretty good in defence, certainly, well, until it gets to the back end of the third week of Grand Tours.
I'm interested to know, though, Rich, what's it actually like out there on the race? I mean, is this the first race you've been to since the Giro last year, of course? But how does it feel in the Paris-Nice bubble? I mean, we joked about
your
curfew.
It's not actually the first race. It's not the first race I've been since Giro, because I went from the Giro to the Tour of Flanders and the 3 days of Depana, you might remember.
Of course you did.
Unusually. It's my first race this season. And, well, Francois Thomazeau and I speak a bit about this in the next part of the podcast. But it's you know, all the same restrictions are in place as were at the Tour de France. But, of course, it's much, much smaller and there are far fewer people. And it's strange. I mean, listening to your friend special, Lionel, and a lot of the history of Paris-Nice and how it eventually, you know, came under the auspices of ASO and has almost become a sort of mini Tour de France, having previously had a very strong identity of its own, symbolised by the white jersey of leader. Now, the yellow jersey of race leader here, it looks very, you know, everything about the race looks identical to the Tour de France, but on a much smaller scale, which is kind of strange and quite nice. You know, it's we're in a beautiful little town today, famous for its pottery, Gien, on the banks of the Loire. Lovely little place. And it was quite sad to see a lot of the shops, which are closed, but nevertheless had put out displays of bikes and so on to welcome Paris-Nice, and yet there was nobody here, you know, nobody really in town to watch the race. So it's like a ghost race in a sense. I don't think that matters for the sport, and it doesn't matter for the TV audience at all. But in terms of the footprint the race makes as it travels around the country, that's obviously much smaller, and you do feel that when you're here on the race.
Well, just reviewing the three stages we've seen so far, Rich, Sam Bennett won the opening stage for De Koenig Quickstep. And since I, kind of criticised them for not getting a win on the board on the opening day of the UAE Tour, I mean, they've won left, right and centre, haven't they? So, you know, they perhaps owe me one for getting the ball rolling for them. Sam Bennett got the race lead, first Irishman to lead the race, not since Sean Kelly, actually, but since Stephen Roach in 1990. And he's got quite a good record at Paris-Nice. I think that was his fourth stage win. Only wins in odd-numbered years, though. And as you said, Rich, Case Bowl of DSM has kind of been waiting for that sort of sprint finish for a little while. As you said, they were there or thereabouts in the Tour de France, but to get one under their belts, you know, bodes well for them as the season unfolds. And their old boy, Michael Matthews, took the yellow jersey briefly, didn't he? But then lost it to Stefan Bissiger, who, well, he was the sensation in the time trial today. And, well, Jonathan Vaughters is was on Twitter talking about how he's basically the most aero rider that he knows of, I think is a layman's way of putting that. I'm not going to get into all the science of that, but CDA, basically frontal area, isn't it? So the hole that the riders are punching in the wind. And yeah, I suppose his performance behind, quite a way behind Filippo Ganna in the UAE, and perhaps didn't take as much notice of his performance there as I should have done, because, well, today he was, you know, very good. And did it by a fraction of a second over Remy Cavagna. But there was a real half hour in that time trial where the lead changed hands. But of the GC riders, to me, Primoz Roglic looks like he's ridden himself into a very strong position and will probably take the yellow jersey on the uphill finish on Wednesday. But that's speculative, of course. Rich, I'm interested to know what Paris-Nice has been feeling like, and I'd like to hear from our old friend Francois Thomazeau. So shall we hear your package from the race to the sun, which is, well, it's not quite reached the sun yet, has it? But it must be getting a little bit warmer.
Mesdames et messieurs, le vainqueur de ce contre-la-montre individuel représentant la Suisse pour la formation EF Education Nippo, Stefan Bissiger.
Well, we heard there the podium, Paris-Nice, today, the presentation of the stage one and the yellow jersey to Stefan Bissiger. Bit of a surprise, although I spoke to Matt Rabin this morning, the EF chiropractor, who did tell me that he was going to win. I wish I'd recorded it, I didn't. I'm joined by Francois Thomazeau. Francois, how are you?
I'm not too bad. I'm pretty well, actually.
You're working for the race. You do this every year, don't you, at Paris-Nice?
Yeah, I've done it 15 years now as you know, the live feed webmaster, or whatever you want to call that, doing the English live feed on Paris-Nice. So all the bullshit you've read on the official website for years is me.
Gnarly bullshit. Fantastic. And Francois, I was surprised to learn that you don't know this place, Gien. This is a new town for you.
Yeah, it's odd. Well, I discovered it was the start of Paris-Bourges, and it still is for many years. So Sam Bennett apparently started Paris-Bourges here and won it twice, and so did John Degenkolb. But the only thing I knew about afterwards is we know about La Faïence de Gien. You know, that's chinaware.
This is going to be my fact. Sorry about that. You've just stolen my fact. I was going to say this is the Stoke-on-Trent of France. I can tell you it's on the Loire as well. I don't know if you'd notice.
Yeah, no, yeah. But it was beautiful. I kind of walked, you know, up to the start today, and by the Loire. I mean, if you watch the race on TV, the final stretch was, along the Loire with a nice old bridge in the background. It's very beautiful.
You can walk over the bridge.
Of course not.
No, how could we forget? It's beautiful. I had my breakfast this morning on some pottery from here, and I was told that was the industry. But it's a slightly struggling town, I was told. But it's nice. I mean, where isn't struggling? Everywhere is closed. That's no real sign of anything. But it's a nice little place, beautiful, and a nice stage. I mean, doing your job, Francois, you're very concentrate on what's happening. Any surprises today for you? I mean, the winner was a surprise for some people, although he has been showing signs of that kind of form. But were there any other surprises today?
Well, on Paris-Nice, the time trial every year is a kind of a surprise. I remember last year Søren Krag Andersen won it. I'm not saying he's not a good time trialist, he is, but you might have expected somebody else. Remember a couple of years ago, maybe 2 years ago, Simon Yates won time trial here, and it's not, you know, time trial is not known as his best discipline. So it's usually a bit of a surprise. Maybe I expected a little bit more from Ron Dennis, for one. Because, you know, I mean, we had the impression yesterday he finished, you know, far away. We had the impression he was saving his strength for this, and that it was the main goal of his early season was to win this.
You know, both those things could be true.
Yeah, sure. But, so a little bit of a disappointment. Tao Gogan Art as well. I was expecting him not to be near the top, but at least I think he lost more than 35 seconds or something, so he's quite a way down in the GC for now. Once again, we you might remember that I forecast that, you know, 2021 might be the return of the old guard. Well, so far not so good for my predictions, because another young and up and coming, you know, 22-year-old, and Rémi Cavagna doing well as well. He's not old either. So, I mean, the rejuvenation of cycling with Mathieu van der Poel in Strade Bianche and Egan Bernal and all these guys, well, the trend seems to be going on. And unfortunately for the old guys like me, you know.
I was wandering around the buses this morning, and it struck me that quite a few big hitters, Primoz Roglic, people like that, are racing for the first time this year here, which is quite late for a lot of them. And a time trial is always a nervous day, especially the first one of the year, because it's a real test of form. And I think there was a lot of interest in Roglic and how he got on. Stephen Kruijswijk did a very good ride today. Roglic, though, you know, he did a strong ride, and when he came across the line, he was first. It looked pretty good at that point. But then, while we were talking to him at the finish, Rémi Cavagna came across the line, and we'll hear Roglic now talking. Quite unusually relaxed, I thought, in quite chipper form, Roglic. And you'll hear, after about 40 seconds, a yell in the background, and that's Rémi Cavagna coming across the line, having just beaten his time.
Obviously, we went quite well. The time was good, so definitely happy with the performance.
How difficult were the rhythm changes?
He's not really so typical time trial, but I think it suits for me. I like it like that. It went well.
Yeah. So a good thing with the climbing stages and prospects. What happened today?
Definitely. I think we showed great preparation. Looking forward for the next stage.
Cavagna is not beating you, so it looks like you might win the stage.
We have to wait till the end always, huh? I also lost a couple of times for less than a second, so let's wait, huh? I did what I could, so as you all know, now quite some history already with the TTs. Always a challenge.
Roglic there, Francois, cracking jokes about time trials being a bit hit or miss for him after Tour de France last year, of course, but a pretty solid ride from him today.
I mean, he remains the clear favourite to win this. I can't see, you know, now in a way, you know, the as usual time trials, they sort the men from the boys, and so now two-thirds of the peloton are out of contention for GC. Is up there with the best. I mean, I'm afraid we won't see Bissega again. I mean, in the mountains or even tomorrow. I mean, he's done his job, he's done his race. So now it's up to the to best guys to battle it out. And if you look really at the GC, the main GC contenders, I mean, Roglic is way up there. So he didn't win this, but he made the first step he was expecting to make to win in Paris. So once again, tomorrow will suit him very well. And as soon as we get towards the mountains, especially La Colmienne, I don't think anybody can really cause him any problems.
Well, you say, Francois, that we'll not see Bissiger again, although he did put up... there was some fighting talk from him about, you know, trying really hard to hold on. We don't really know what to expect from tomorrow's finish, I suppose. He, though, looks like a very promising rider, and he was talking at the finish about really targeting not just time trials, but the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, which made me think. You christened Mark Hirschi last year at the Tour de France Baby Spartacus. But could we have a new baby Spartacus? I mean, is Mark Hershey now yesterday's man, and we've got a new baby Spartacus?
Well, if you look at the Cancellara heritage, I mean, it's not only Hershey. I mean, Stephen Kung was one. They really have a strong, and I mean, it shows. I mean, for those of you following track, they've shown in the recent past, especially in the younger ranks, they've got a great pursuit team and the good guys on the track. That's where Bissiger comes from. So yeah, as you know, in the pursuit team, you've got four guys plus the substitute. So obviously, there's more than one baby Spartacus there.
Triplets. What are four? Quadruplets.
Quadruplets. So I don't know. There are probably some missing names there. Some of the guys who we should have a look at the Swiss team and see maybe other up and coming young riders there. But yeah, obviously, it's funny. Jonathan Waters was getting carried away again on Twitter today with about Bissiger. But yeah, it's funny because the name was kind of crawling around the Zone Technique and the finish line today before he started. You know, don't forget him. He was pretty close to Ghana in the UAE Tour earlier in the season. So yeah, the main, you know, outside bet this morning was probably Bissiger. As you mentioned, apparently the first time he made an impression on the road was in Paris-Roubaix Junior, I think. So yeah, it seems quite logical that he should go for classics, or that the type of classics like Hershey and like all these guys. So yeah, a new generation of Swiss talent is obviously up and coming with Fabian Cancellara in the background.
Bissiger, we did speak to him at the finish. Let's hear a little bit from him now.
I'm always good in time trials. You know, I was on the track before UAE Tour, and that helped a lot, I would say, for UAE Tour already, because you get the speed in the legs and you got the power in the legs. And was not actually that I worked like 2 months just for this race, but I'm always good in time trials. So when the power is there, I can put the same power out on the time trial bike like on the road bike. Like, that's a big quality for me, and we'll see where it brings me.
Jonathan Waters was saying how aerodynamic you are. Is your position something you've worked on a lot, or is it natural that you are able to find that position on the bike?
Yeah, for sure we work a lot on the position, but it's not like a super crazy position at the moment. It's just, it's good, but you cannot compare, you know, with all the measurements you take, it's always like different. You can't compare the measurements you take on this day to another day, because there are always different measurements because of the wind and pressure and temperature and all this kind of stuff. So, but it's definitely, I think we worked good in the position. We had really fast material as well.
Well, that was the new race leader, Stefan Bissiger, a very talented rider, clearly. Francois, how has Paris been for you? You were mentioning as we were walking up to this, well, we found a bar, which is a result. We're not allowed inside, but we're standing outside having a beer. It's a strange kind of atmosphere. You were comparing it to last year when it felt like things were shutting down. Here, there's still a lot of uncertainty around everything. And restrictions that we're all living by, but how is it overall?
It's I mean, we got used within a year, as you know. I mean, we're all in the same boat. I mean, our lives changed, and last year was kind of a bit of a collapse. We saw as the race was unfolding last year that the restrictions were getting, you know, sharper and sharper, and it was. I remember being in the car last year with my mate Louis Doucet doing the live feed in French, and we couldn't believe the news that they were going to close down the schools and that we were going to be locked down. I mean, it's only 3 days before the end of Paris. It was impossible. We couldn't believe it, and it did happen, as we know. And actually, the race to La Colmiane, up La Colmiane, with Nairo Quintana winning the stage, and was actually the last big sports event before the world went into lockdown. So it was a real shock. And now we got used to life being a little bit different. As you say, we're having a beer outside, so it's not exactly back to normal. but and we, every time, every night when we go into the hotel, for instance, tonight we're driving to the next day's finish. We were told, and that's been the case since the start of this Paris-Nice, that there are we've got, you know, trays with our dinner waiting for us in our room and microwave ovens in hotel rooms, you know, to...
It's not like traveling with a cycling podcast, is it?
No, well, we don't know what it's going to be, you know, for the tour or the rest of it, but...
How would Lionel deal with that?
I don't know. I mean, if that's cassoulet waiting for him at every stage, or but maybe once in a while a little andouillette, you know, and because in a way,
Francois phones ahead.
Yeah, if you I guess you phone ahead and ask for. Now we don't have a real choice of the menu, but so far I must say it's been a pleasant surprise. Yesterday we were in a classic, you know. Chain hotel, but the food was pretty good. It was pretty cool, and I mean nobody stops you from sharing your meal with the next door neighbor and sharing a bottle of wine. With my mate Louis, before this party started, the first thing we did, because it was the most important thing to do, was we went to the local wine cellar and we bought bottles for the whole of Paris-Nice, because I mean to fall short of wine one day back from the stage would be impossible. So we've got the munition in the boot, so we should be all right.
Wine vending machines, surely, for in France, you would think. We're heading into Sancerre country tomorrow. Aren't we?
Yeah, tomorrow is going to be a great stage because it's all in Beaujolais, in the Beaujolais area, finishing in Chiroub, which is one of the several appellations of Beaujolais. So every year on Paris-Nice, it's something, you know, the organizers obviously they love their wine quite a bit, and it's very often as you've noticed, it's something with the tour as well. We have a time trial in Saint-Emilion this year, in the next Tour de France. There's a tradition of wine and and time trial and wine seems to have a, tomorrow it's not a time trial, but it's going to be up and down the hills of Beaujolais. We're going through all the main appellations of Beaujolais. So yeah, I mean, you know, it kind of teases your appetite. You know, at the end of the stage, I mean, you've been through Chiroub, Morgon, and all those places, and you think, how about, you know, tasting every one of the wines we've been riding through? Yeah, so. But to get back to your first question about the change in 1 year's time, my impression, I might be wrong, but we really had the impression last year that everything was collapsing and closing down, and now it's kind of opening up a little bit. I mean, the setup of cycling, you know, races has been pretty good. I mean, as we saw at the end of last season, and now that's kind of a setup that works. In terms of, you know, riders staying in bubbles, we don't have many COVID cases, and like rugby or football, maybe because it's even more of an open air sport. I don't know precisely the reasons why, but things are, you know, slowly getting in their pace, and a lot of little procedures are taking shape, getting into place. One little thing I wanted to mention is, for instance, you know, George Bennett, who crashed yesterday, and there was concern from many of us, and I saw a few of the podcast listeners about the procedures. I talked to some guys this morning from the.
He banged his head and looked like
and lost his helmet was crashed. But apparently, even in this area, you know, progress has been made, because apparently yesterday when he crashed and lost his helmet, he was really apparently there's questions to be asked for a minute, and he has to answer to every one of them, and then the ambulance, you know, followed him for 1 mile to make sure everything was okay. So you know, I think that there are some little processes imposed by the coronavirus and imposed by the health measures and everything for the last year that are you know, getting there. And so yeah, my impression so far is of a kind of a opening up. We'll see in Nice, because Nice is a problem, because Nice is in lockdown. So it's quite probable that, well, it's quite possible that the last stage won't be exactly what we think it could be. There might be a change of of the course. It might finish in some other place, because actually places outside of Nice, if you're not by the sea, are not locked down, but Nice itself is locked down. So whether the organizers decide for political reasons, it's not very good to have Paris-Nice taking place in a desert town. We'll see. But that's the only thing that could affect the outcome. But so far, my impression is more of an opening up.
Yes, I think there is a plan B, isn't there? But there is, as you say, a confidence that bike racing can happen in these circumstances. And Paris-Nice always a varied race. You know, we've seen sprint stages already, a couple of sprint stages. And I spoke today at the end of the time to Michael Morkov, Sam Bennett's lead out man. He's had a lot of attention this year, I think, because I think more than ever his role has been recognised and his ability in that role has been recognised. And he is an outstanding lead-out man. When you watch him do his job, he's not like a lot of lead-out men, and I put this question to him, in the past have been, in effect, second-rate sprinters who have not been quite good enough to be sprinters in their own right and have become lead-out men. He's a bit different. He was never a sprinter. He's a different kind of rider. He's spent a lot of time on the track, where he's honed a lot of these kind of bike handling skills that he has. So I wanted to speak to him about the role that he performs so well and has done now at that team, the Koenig Quickstep, for several sprinters, most recently Sam Bennett. Michael, Sam was talking yesterday about your qualities as a lead-out man. There's been a lot of attention on that this year. I mean, how do you, as you go through your career, how do you feel like you improve as a lead-out man? There's always a lot of focus on the sprinters and what sort of level they're at, but how do you sort of analyse your own performance?
Yeah, well, actually, I only discovered myself as a lead-out man quite late in my career, since I spent the most of my career on GC team, trying to be a domestic there. So it was quite late. Only when I moved to Katusha, I started to work more on the lead-outs, and there I discovered that some of the skills I have from the track and as a cyclist suited really well to be in the bunch sprint. I don't have the power enough myself to actually win the sprint, but I have some abilities who is worth for a sprinter.
I guess a lot of lead-out men are sprinters who become lead-out men. You've kind of taken a slightly different path.
Yeah, because often you see that it's former sprinters who can't succeed on their own. They turn out to be lead-out men, which is often a little bit difficult because, in my opinion, the mentality for a sprinter is quite different for being a lead-out man, since a traditional sprinter often tend to wait too long. As a lead-out man, you sometimes need to wind it up earlier. And I think the approach I found on the sprint seems to work really well.
And when we watch you in bunch sprints, you and Sam talked about your calmness. You look very calm. You look very relaxed on the bike. Do you feel that, or is that deceiving slightly?
Of course, it's not calm, but I try to stay calm. I think that's a part of my experience. I've been in a lot of bunch sprints. I study them a lot, and I often realize that it's actually by staying calm and wait for your moment that you take the biggest wins, instead of trying to push something which is not there. So that's pretty much the recipe that I'm working with.
I mean, you have to be fast, obviously, to be there at all. Is that something that you work on now more, that it's a big part of your job, your speed?
Absolutely. I mean, a big, very big part of my training is done in the velodrome in Copenhagen, not so far from my house. I do there a lot of training behind the Dernies and speed, basically. And I feel that is really my big advantage, that I have the track and I have some good friends around me helping me to do the motor pacing with me.
And the awareness as well, I guess, of other bodies around you, that comes from the track as well, I guess.
Yeah, I think I'm sure, like, at the same time you see a lot of the cross riders in the moment, they bring a lot of capacity from their sport. I believe I bring a lot of skills with me from the track, in terms of sitting really close, being narrow, always make sure you have a gap to move, and etc. So
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that my track background helped me in this kind of work.
Well, that was Michael Morkov telling us a little bit about his role as lead-out man for Sam Bennett. They'll have another opportunity, won't they, on Thursday. Should be a sprint stage, I think.
Yeah, Sam Bennett was saying today that, you know, he really, really just tried to make the time cut and spare his legs for Thursday. And as you mentioned, Morkov, he talked about Morkov the other day after winning stage one in Saint-Cyr-l'École. He said something, you know, like, whatever I do and whatever position I'm in, I know that, you know, Michael, he seems to deliver me. He's always, you know, around, and whatever the circumstances, he seems to lead me out perfectly well. So, that, as you said, he reads the finishes very well. He's probably one of the best bike handlers in the bunch, and obviously he helps Bennett with his confidence very, very much.
I think Michael Morkov could probably lead me out in a sprint. he looks so good. I mean, he's to watch him, and when you watch the overhead angle in particular, the way that he looks so relaxed and calm as he's moving himself around, maneuvering himself around. He mentioned himself that the current vogue is cyclocross, and everybody's saying cyclocross is the thing that is going to produce great champions. But in the past, the track has been talked about in the same way. And I think he is a testament to what you can gain from the track in terms of speed, but also bike handling, certainly.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, in terms of skill, as you say, cyclocross is great. Well, I know you haven't been known as the number one advocate of cyclocross.
Advocates, yes. Experts, no.
But, no, I agree. I mean, cyclocross. But it's different skills, you know. There's no, you know, bunching. I mean, there's no bunch technique in cyclocross. You have to handle the mud and maybe there's a little bit of a struggle as a bunch at the start, like in a cross country, you know, a pedestrian race. But then once you're gone, it's, you know, one man and following another guy, and the skills are different. But the skills of handling your bike well in a peloton of 100 guys speeding at, you know, 70 k's an hour is different from cyclocross. So it depends on, you know, it depends what we're talking about. But in terms of, you know, really keeping your place at exactly the right in the right position in a speeding peloton, well, track obviously is unreplaceable.
Don't get us in more trouble with cyclocross fans, Francois. I was nervous seeing where you were going there. It's wonderful. It's a great, great sport, and we'll be returning to it next winter, for sure. Well, listen, Francois, you've got a long drive ahead of you now, and I've got a short drive ahead of me and a long drive in the morning. But I'll catch up with you later on in Pioneers.
Sure. I mean, whenever you want, we'll be around, and, you know, always nice to talk a little bit.
Catch up over an illicit beer standing outside a bar.
Absolutely, that's a new. I mean, that's the funny thing also about the coronavirus situation, because these days you can't sit in a bar drinking beer, but you can order a beer at the counter and you know stay up outside having a beer. I can't really tell the difference in many ways. You know,
no, it's in posh plastic glasses, and we'll return these now. I'll be all changed at the tour, Francois. I'll be back to more or less normal, I'm sure. You, me, and Lionel will be enjoying our andouillette and drinking our wine.
In your room, yeah, on a tray, maybe. I don't know. No, I don't know. Do we know where we'll be in July? I mean, the good thing as well from the COVID-19 situation is that we and it's quite good to you remember, I mean, as journalists we always complain about sports people saying, well, I'm taking it a day at a time, but that's what we all do thanks to coronavirus, you know. Thanks for to coronavirus to turn us all into sports people.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our longtime supporters. And if you would like 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Keep your questions coming as well for James Morton of Science in Sport. We've got quite a few already. Email contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. if you've got a question about your own nutrition or that of the pros. Well, that was Francois Tomaso and I at Paris-Nice, and we'll hear again from Francois next week, I hope. One thing that we have not done yet this week is, of course, everyone's favourite section, Slow Radio. And this week I asked Lizzie Banks if she could record some audio of her wrecking Strada Bianca before the race. So here she was riding those white dust roads on the Thursday before the race. Well, that was Lizzie Banks on the Strada Bianca. Thanks very much for that, Lizzie. You can hear Lizzie in Service Course, of course, our monthly tech show. Now, Stefan Bissiger won the time trial today. Matt Rabin, as I mentioned in that piece, had tipped him. He's a chiropractor at EF Education Nippo. That's the name of the team this year. I messaged him later on to ask him for some intel on Bissiger, and he replied, "Good kid." So that's really helpful. Now we know. Thanks for that, Matt. But listen, chaps, we're going to play out. I'm back with Daniel and Lionel again. We're going to play out, aren't we, with the full version of the song that's been composed by Steve Nichols in New Zealand. Recorded just him and his guitar in the basement with a phone and an acoustic guitar. So a fantastic effort, Steve.
Well, word of this whole saga fiasco has definitely got around. I did an interview with Giro champion Theo Gegenhardt, our old mate, before Paris-Nice, and he slipped in some reference to my favourite spaceman, Sivakov.
Well, Sivakov himself, I sent him the track, and he was impressed. Maybe we'll hear his reaction to it at the end of the song, shall we? Playing us out, Steve Nichols with his fantastic ode to Daniel and Pavel Sivakov. And that's all from us for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Over to ground control, then.
I was just waiting for Major Tom Pidcock. I was waiting for Major Tom Pidcock to win the race.
Oh, ow. Ow.
Daniel Free. Sivakov, Daniel Free to Sivakov. Take your SIS gels and put your helmets on. Daniel Free to Sivakov. Pinarello ready to hop on. Check positions, UCI legal too. This is Daniel Freeb to Sivakov. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know your grenadiers. Now it's time to ride to the moon if you dare. This is Sivakov to Daniel Freeb. I'm riding out the door, but I'm not sure that you've really checked your math. Should the decimal point be more to the left?
Morning, Richard. So good, so funny. It's crazy how much imaginations the listeners have. This is great.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.